I'll take any cheap excuse I can to play some Elvis Costello, even though that has everything to do with writing a story about love. You could say, in a way, that that is at the core of the Aleppo Codex. It's a story of devotion to getting a hand-copied version of the Bible exactly right. The first five books, in particular, the Pentateuch, the most important part, the core, the heart of the Hebrew Scriptures. And that was the Aleppo Codex. It was the perfect book. It was the book that became so renowned for its accuracy and its beauty that it was simply referred to as the crown. And the fact that it ended up in a kind of an obscure town in Syria is a story in and of itself, but it's what happens after the formation of Israel in 1947, the disappearance of the crown, of the Aleppo Codex. Where did it go? How did it get from Syria into Israel? Why were pages missing? Why have you very likely never heard of this book? And why you will never forget it after tonight's show, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, it's so interesting that Prometheus came out this past weekend. It was on my list of things to do, and I totally forgot about it until I just heard that commercial for Prometheus. I got to go see that this week. It looks so good. And it's one of the threads kind of we've been covering for years on Coast to Coast, but this is another one. The idea of certain sacred texts of which we have heard little over the years, or perhaps in this case, not at all, learned a lot about the Aleppo Codex here, the true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. But it's actually so much more than that. Matty Friedman is the author of this book. He's an Associated Press writer. Stationed in Jerusalem, came from Canada, was it, Maddie, when you were a teenager, your first time to Israel?
Yep. Born and raised in Toronto.
And still in Jerusalem, even as we speak.
That is correct. Speaking to you from Jerusalem.
All right. Great job on this book. Not just part journalist here, obviously you had to be part detective. No, I'll go another. You had to be like part spy. There were certain things you did in uncovering these details here, which bordered on espionage. You had to, it was tricky. They put you through your paces to try to get this information, but it's great. But before we go into the Aleppo Codex, let's talk a little bit about Syria, because it's been in the news lately too. And I know since you're there, and this it'll form an interesting backdrop when we get into the history of this a little bit. Things obviously pretty tense in Syria, and there's a lot of fighting. And we keep getting these stories of these massacres that are happening, and it seems like the country is in a kind of lockdown, not unlike what happened back in the 40s when the Aleppo Codex story starts here. But tell us a little bit. What are you hearing now in Jerusalem? What's the word on the street? What's the future of Syria as you're hearing it?
Certainly people in Israel are following the situation in Syria with a lot of interest and some concern, because there hasn't been unrest like this in Syria for many, many decades. They've had a very stable and very brutal dictatorship that has kept things very quiet over there in terms of the internal politics of the country for many, many years. And a situation of prolonged instability in Syria, or a change of government that would see perhaps a less rational leadership in Syria or more extreme leadership in Syria, is certainly a reason for concern in Israel. And people here are watching it unfold, as I know many people are in America and elsewhere.
How are things for non-Muslims in Syria these days?
That is a very interesting question. There were traditionally two significant communities of non-Muslims in Syria for many, many centuries, for millennia, as a matter of fact. One of those communities was the Jewish community, which existed largely in Damascus, the capital, and in Aleppo, which is the center of my story, and which has been in the news recently because there's been violence there as well as part of the recent unrest. But beginning in the mid-20th century, beginning with the the creation of the State of Israel, the Jewish community was forced out. And today, with the exception of about a dozen people in Damascus, there are no Jews left in Syria.
About a dozen brave Jews left in Damascus.
There are a dozen or so. A colleague of mine visited there several years ago and met some of the remaining Jews in Damascus. Those who remain are mainly elderly, people who can't leave or who don't want to leave. Those who could get out got out long ago. Many of them live in Israel and many of them live in America. There is a significant community of Christians in Syria, and I haven't reported from inside Syria, but my understanding is that the Christians have long been supporters of the regime because the regime protects them from the Muslim majority, and they've kind of tied their fate to that of the Assad regime, and I'm sure that they are among the most concerned observers of the current situation inside Syria, because if things get much worse there, it's always minorities who suffer, and certainly the Christians could find themselves facing a very dire situation in the next couple of years.
Well, I hate to see it anytime a Christian community makes a deal with the devil, and even for their own existence, such as what seems to be the case going on in Syria. But that actually, there's a precedent for that, and that's as we go back. Well, let's talk about the city of Aleppo, because at the time that Syria became very hostile to Jews after the formation of Israel in 1947, there were a few pro-Syria, anti-Israel Jews in Syria as well. That it forced a weird line for people who nationally had considered themselves Syrian, although they were Jewish, and suddenly they were caught up in this intrigue as Israel was forming as a nation and Syria as a country was turning against it. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. There's a very interesting tension that is created in the first decades of the 20th century. It's important to remember, it's kind of forgotten history, but it's very, very crucial to understanding today's Middle East and certainly the state of Israel. But there were about 1 million Jews across the Islamic world in the mid-20th century, and these were communities that had been there, in many cases, before the birth of Islam. In Aleppo, the Jewish community had existed for centuries before the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. So they existed in Aleppo for about 1,000 years before the birth of Islam. So though we speak of these communities as being Jewish communities in the lands of Islam, in many cases they predated Islam by a long, long time. They were part of the local landscape. Their language was Arabic. They were never equal to Muslims. Under Muslim rule, they were always second-class citizens, but there was a kind of coexistence that existed for a long time in these countries. And in the 20th century, new ideas of nationalism begin to arise in the Middle East from Europe. And the identity of most people in the Middle East had always been religious. They had been primarily Muslim. And what happens in the early years of the 20th century is that the idea of Arab nationalism takes root. So the idea is that Arabs as a nation, as an ethnic group, have to have their own political leadership. They need their own state. And that happens parallel to the same idea taking root among Jews. Jews had always identified primarily religiously, and they had been Jewish people living in Germany or Jewish people living in Russia or Jewish people living in Morocco or Jewish people living in Baghdad. But now there was an idea that Jews themselves were an ethnic group who needed their own state. And these two ideas are on a collision course, Arab nationalism and Jewish nationalism, that explodes in 1948 with the creation of the State of Israel.
So the buildup for this is that in Aleppo, in Syria, in this city, there is a copy of the first five books of the Hebrew Bible, the Pentateuch, and these first five books, as you know, we know them from any Bible, but they very much the very important, you know, core of the scriptures, and this copy of those scriptures were considered so important, so perfect, that it was called the crown. And of all places, it ended up in this city of Aleppo, Syria, which then gets into play when the formation of Israel, the formal vote that's taken by the UN in 1948. Explain what the book is, what the Aleppo Codex was from the very beginning, from when it was first created, and what made it so special And then we'll talk more about how it disappears and about the pages and the power of it. But let's go back to the very beginning for the Aleppo Codex.
Sure. For the very beginning would be around the year 930 A.D. The Aleppo Codex was written in the city of Tiberias, which is on the banks, the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. And it was written by a scholar whose name we still know. His name was Aaron ben Asher, and a scribe whose name was Shlomo ben Buya'a. And it consisted not only of the Pentateuch, of the five books of Moses, but of the entire Hebrew Bible with all 24 books. So that would include Daniel and Ecclesiastes and Esther and Ruth and all of the books of what Christians refer to as the Old Testament.
Sure.
And to understand why it was created, it's useful to go back about 9 centuries before that in the summer of the year 70 AD when Roman legions destroyed the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. Because until that point, Jews had lived in the same country and they had spoken the same language and they had shared political leadership and they had been a nation like other nations. But when the temple is destroyed and the exile begins, the Jews are scattered. And they're scattered eventually across the world from New York and Los Angeles to Casablanca and Baghdad and Tehran and Moscow. And they have to be somehow held together. And this has never been done successfully before because dispersion always meant destruction. Scattered people had never managed to survive before. And what emerged was a revolutionary idea, which was that a scattered people could be held together by the written word. They would be held together by a book that they would all read. And this book is the Hebrew Bible, of course. And for that to work, you need a perfect version of the text. Because any minor divergence in the way the text is written could lead to a splintering of the faith. If the people in Casablanca are reading one book and the people in Krakow are reading another book, that could end up with two different religions. Because religious texts are subject to such intense interpretation, every detail is important. So the process of many centuries in which the text is redacted and edited and perfected, and the perfect version of the text, the authoritative version that would serve as the key, the master copy of the Hebrew Bible, is the Aleppo Codex, the crown, which is written in 930 in Tiberias. Of course, it's not called the Aleppo Codex. At the time, it only arrived in Aleppo when it is already very, very old. From Tiberias, it ends up in Jerusalem, the walled city of Jerusalem in the 11th century, in the hands of a Jewish community there. And it's in Jerusalem when the Crusaders arrive in 1099, the First Crusade. And the Crusaders aren't particularly interested in the Jews. They're primarily interested in redeeming the Holy Sepulchre from the Muslims. But there are a considerable number of Jews inside Jerusalem. And in fact, there are Crusader chroniclers who tell us that the defenders of Jerusalem, when the Crusaders arrived, were Muslims and Jews, Jews who participated in defense of the city. The Codex is taken by the Crusaders after they conquer Jerusalem, and it is redeemed, it's ransomed by the Jews of Cairo, who are the most wealthy and important Jewish community in the area at the time. They send an envoy with money to buy back human captives from the Crusaders and to buy back valuable manuscripts from the Crusaders. Because, of course, we have to remember what a book was in those days. I mean, there were no printing presses. There was no Kindle. There was no Library of Congress. Books existed in one copy. And the Aleppo Codex existed in one copy, and in fact, the Aleppo Codex existed in one copy until the mid-20th century. There were no photographs of the book. There were no known copies of the book. If the book were ever lost, Judaism's most important manuscript, it was just lost. The information inside was irreplaceable, so obviously that made it very valuable. And it was ransomed back from the Crusaders, and it ends up in Cairo. And in Cairo, it reaches the desk of a philosopher and an important scholar of Jewish law named Moses Maimonides. Maimonides' day job was as a physician in the court of Saladin in Cairo. And he wrote a very important work of Jewish law, and in this work he writes explicitly that the authoritative version of the Hebrew Bible, as far as he is concerned, is this manuscript that came from Tiberias. And he describes the manuscript, and we're talking about the crown, about the Aleppo Codex, and because Maimonides is considered probably the greatest mind in Jewish thought over the past several millennia and one of the great minds in Western philosophy. that gives the book a stamp of approval as the perfect biblical text, and that's an importance that it retains to this day. And it's Maimonides' great-grandson's grandson, so a descendant of Maimonides, who leaves Cairo at a time of political upheaval in Cairo and takes the Codex to Aleppo. He travels north to Aleppo, which is an important trading city in Syria, and it's hidden in the great synagogue of Aleppo for 600 years.
600 years. I'm gonna have you unpack some other parts of that coming up in a minute, but I want to stress that with a parallel. It's so interesting because, you know, I think we all think we understand about Bibles because, you know, that we all kind of grow up around hearing about sacred scriptures, but this is such a unique book. And it not just because of its physical existence, but also, as you said, Maimonides, who's like really one of the coolest guys in the history of history,
definitely,
is the guy who looks at it, who uses that for his writing. It's a little bit like, this is kind of a lame comparison for Americans maybe, but it'd be sort of like if there was a perfect copy of the Constitution that Abraham Lincoln had carried with him in his hand, you know.
That's a great comparison, in my opinion.
While he was writing the Gettysburg Address or something. You know, I mean, it's like the compounding of history on top of itself. But let's talk again about the Aleppo Codex itself, because, as you said, it was like the best scribe. So the person that did the scribal work on the codex, but also the commentary that goes along with it. And that part is somewhat of what makes this so beautiful, because the guy that was doing the writing knew the entire Bible by heart.
That's right. It's quite clear that both of the scholars, the scholar and the scribe who were behind the Aleppo Codex, knew the entire text of the Bible by heart. If you go to see the manuscript, or what remains of the manuscript today in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, it looks like it might have been run off on a laser printer. The scribal work is so meticulous, so exact, that the size of the letters doesn't change, the shape of the letters don't change over the entire manuscript, and we're talking about 300,000 words. This would have been years and years of work. So the scribe, Ben Buya'a, was definitely a professional, and the scholar who was in charge of creating the Aleppo Codex, was kind of the director of the edition, Aaron Ben Asher, is recognized as the greatest textual scholar of those times, the greatest expert in the perfection of the biblical text. So Ben Buya wrote the text of the Bible, and it was Ben Asher who added in notes in the margins. If there was a rare word that appeared in a certain passage, Ben Asher would note that this is a word that appears nowhere else in the text. If there's a word that was written in one way but needs to be read another way, and that's an interesting peculiarity in the Hebrew Bible, there are certain words that are not read as they are written, Ben Asher would note that. And he added in all of the vowel symbols in Hebrew. Hebrew is largely written without vowels, like in Arabic.
Right.
And that's one of the problems here. If you open up a Torah scroll in a synagogue, even if you know Hebrew, you can't read the scroll, because the information that you need to read it is not written. All that appears are consonants. But to read the scroll, you need to know vowels, and you need to have the musical notes to which the text is supposed to be chanted, which also serves as punctuation. There's no punctuation in the scroll, and that can lead to
misreading.
Many misunderstandings, of course.
Yeah.
And take the word, in English, take the word HT. If you open up a Hebrew Bible, you see the word HT. Is that word hat? Is it hit? Is it hate? Is it heat?
Right.
I mean, who knows? You need external information. You need another book that tells you how to read this book. That book is the Aleppo Codex.
That's the amazing part about it. So I hope we have sufficiently identified what makes the Aleppo Codex so special. We'll get into what makes the Aleppo Codex so mysterious coming up in just a minute, including its mysterious disappearance, reappearance, and the problems that result from its disappearance, many of which are still unresolved, some of which have never been known until now. The new book, The Aleppo Codex, Maddie Friedman. More on this next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, there's a few angels overseeing the fate of the Aleppo Codex, at least so it would seem, and then a few demons along the way trying to destroy it. We'll bring you up to current day, the current state of the Aleppo Codex in a few minutes, and also why some people have an understanding of it, a word that could only be, I think, used to describe accurately their perception of the Aleppo Codex is mystical, and they're actually afraid of its power. But we'll get back to that. Maddie Friedman is the author of the new book, the defining book about the story of this hitherto unknown to most Western followers of history, the story of the Aleppo Codex. And Maddie has to tell the story of the number of scholars, people who are along the chain of saving the Aleppo Codex or knowing of the Aleppo Codex that actively tried to keep him from knowing about it, from writing about it, went out of their way to make it hard for him to find the whole truth. And we'll tell you more about that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Maddie Friedman is a Associated Press writer in Jerusalem who's written the definitive book so far on the Aleppo Codex. And he can say that, I think, with some accuracy, because up until this point, many people were not allowed to know what he was able to discover. And he only did that through tenacity and proving himself worthy of this knowledge and some interesting tests we'll tell you about. But first, I want to get back a little bit to the creation of what the Aleppo Codex is, again, because we're talking about a copy of the Bible, a copy of what Christians refer to as the Old Testament, but the Hebrew Scriptures, and the perfection of this text from the scribe who did it, which, as you said, was almost like looking at somebody who'd been able to use a laser printer in the Middle Ages, to the scholar that was there to do some of the annotations that exist in the Aleppo Codex. But there's even kind of more to it than that, because it has to be perfect. And I don't think people realize this. You're familiar with the whole story about the Bible code, right? Some people that have been able to find words in the using the Hebrew alphabet that, you know, that align in the text of.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right. What's always bothered me about that is something you said earlier, and that's unless you know what the vowel markers are, you cannot possibly know what. I mean, it's to mess with it just by putting up the letters and then to find, you know, to be able to find words that pop up in those letters. That's a very tricky thing. As you point out in the book, in the traditional way of looking at it, Jews will not accept an imperfect book, and that includes it has to have all of the exact marks on it. Can't be any stray marks, can't be any damage to it. The book has to be repaired, or the scroll has to be repaired before it can be re-entered into the use in the synagogue, correct?
Yeah, that's right, and it's worth some explanation, because that's a real difference in this case between the way that Jewish people read the Bible and Christians read the Bible.
Yep.
In the Hebrew Bible, the spelling has to be exact. There can be no flaws in the way the text is written. In the New Testament, for example, the spelling of a certain word is not a matter of theological importance if you can understand the meaning of that word.
Exactly.
And take as an example the word center. You know, and it might be written C-E-N-T-E-R. It might be written C-E-N-T-R-E if it's in Canada or the UK. But that doesn't make the Bible less accurate. It doesn't make it an imperfect Bible. But in the Hebrew Bible, that would. If a word were spelled in a different way, that would disqualify the text from use, because every single word, all 300,000 words in the Hebrew Bible, have to be written exactly as is prescribed by religious law. And the matter of perfection in the text has a rational explanation, which I mentioned before, which is that you have people scattered all over the world who are bound together basically only by this book, and any minor difference in the text could push them apart, could lead to a different interpretation of the same text. That's kind of an explanation that makes sense to us, but there are other explanations in Judaism that are more mystical. The matter of perfection in the text is a matter of almost of religious significance, because this is a text that was given to us by God, and you can't get anything wrong even if you don't understand why. There's information in the text that we don't necessarily understand. There are some strange markings in the Torah scroll. There are certain vowel symbols that we don't even pronounce today. For example, there's a vowel symbol that changes the vowel ah into the vowel ah.
Just right, right. Example. It's like, you know, double A-H to A-H, right.
Just... Exactly. We don't even pronounce that. A person reading the Torah scroll in synagogue won't even pronounce, won't differentiate between those two, but it's written in the Aleppo Codex. And that information has to be preserved even if we don't use it, and even if we don't understand it, because losing information that we have means we're losing information that God wanted us to have. Even if we don't understand what it means now, we might have understood it once, and we may understand it again one day. And in the meantime, we have to preserve it. There's a mystical tradition in Judaism that all five books of the Torah, the five books of Moses, are all one long version of the name of God.
Yeah,
which is another way of telling us that you better not get anything wrong, because the perfection of the text is a matter of religious significance.
Right. And so, you know, again, just for people who we're talking about Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy.
Right. That's the five books of Moses.
That's right.
And so that's the heart of the Hebrew Bible.
The core. And if we're going to look for another Christian comparison to this, we might say that if all Christians had to read the New Testament in Greek, and you couldn't ever change a letter of the Greek, and we, you know, that every Christian liturgy was done in Greek, that would be, that's closer to what we're talking about. But again, that shows the importance of this book, that there was not one thing wrong with it. It was an exact, perfect version, and it was done in a book form as opposed to a scroll, which is another thing that makes it so unique. When it was done, that it was done on, was it vellum? Is that what they did it on?
It was done on parchment, not vellum. We don't even know if it was goat or cattle, because the leather workers in Tiberias did such a great job of processing the parchment that experts today can't even tell what kind of livestock were used to make the parchment of the Aleppo Codex. But it wasn't vellum. It was kind of regular, high quality animal skin.
But this is what makes it so unique, and everything was perfect about this book. And as Maddie went over the history, it ends up in this town, and I'm going to say this, a fairly obscure town. I mean, this isn't even like, I mean, we don't know Syria, we don't hear, but it's not one of the marquee names of the Middle East that we hear about. Damascus, Jerusalem, Cairo. It's Aleppo, and Aleppo doesn't have quite the, it's just not a very sexy name in the history of the Middle East.
For Westerners, it's definitely a B-list.
It sounds like a missing Marx brother is what it sounds like.
But for here, Aleppo is quite an important city. In Syria, it's the second most important city after Damascus, but it certainly has never been, it's never really been in the news except for now. Probably more people have heard about Aleppo in the last few months in the West than have ever heard about the city because of the political unrest that's
right.
going on there.
But I mean, it's not like even saying Cleveland, it's like saying Akron or something, you know, but this is where it ends up. And it ends up in this very old synagogue and this community that's dedicated. They love the fact that the Aleppo Codex, as it has become known, that this book ended up there, and they guard it. And as you said, they guard it for 600 years until it suddenly comes into play when Israel is created, and many of the Muslims, but not all of them, but many of the Muslims of Syria decide to go on an anti-Semitic campaign through the city of Aleppo. Talk about that night that Israel was voted by the UN into nationhood.
Certainly. Maybe I can go back just one step earlier
sure.
to say that the community always believed that the book protected them. So over the 600 years that the Aleppo Codex is kept in the synagogue in Aleppo, it starts out as a scholarly resource, and over the years it becomes less of a scholarly resource and more of a religious icon, almost a symbol of the community. And there are all kinds of stories and beliefs that are woven around the Codex, largely to protect it. And the main belief is that the book protects the community, and if anything ever happens to the book, if it's ever removed from the synagogue, the community will be destroyed. And if you ever talk to old Jewish people from Aleppo, they like to point out that that actually happened. The book is removed from the synagogue and the community is destroyed, and today there's not a single Jew left in Aleppo.
Isn't that amazing?
The book is kept in 1947, around the time of the important UN vote. The UN vote happens at Flushing Meadow, New York City, and the vote is on November 29th, 1947, and they're voting on whether to partition the territory of Palestine, which is then ruled by the British, into two states, one for Jews and one for Arabs. And at this time, the codex is kept in the synagogue, where it's always been kept, in a dark grotto called the Cave of Elijah the Prophet. And it's kept in a safe that has two locks. And it has two locks so that it can't be opened by only one person. Two different community elders have a key, different keys. And they both have to be present in order to open the safe. And that's a way of getting the guardians of the codex to keep an eye on each other. And the codex is almost never removed from its safe, and there have been attempts to obtain it, there'd be attempts to buy it from the community that always rebuffed these attempts. They'd also rebuffed attempts to photograph it. That's why on November 29th, 1947, 1,000 years after the Codex was written, there were no copies of the Aleppo Codex. Judaism's most important book existed only in the original, in the copy that was kept in that safe. And the day after the UN vote, the UN, of course, votes to partition Palestine and the Jews in what would become Israel, and across the world celebrate this sense of national redemption after a 2,000-year exile. But for people in the Arab world, this was a terrible humiliation. And it was kind of the imposition of a foreign entity in the heart of what they considered to be the Islamic world. And there are riots across the Middle East. The Middle East erupts. And the target of these riots are local Jewish communities, these communities that we mentioned earlier that existed for centuries and were very much native communities that in some cases, like Aleppo, predated the birth of Islam. In Aleppo, mobs begin stalking Jewish areas, and they burn Jewish homes, and they burn Jewish businesses, and they burn 18 synagogues. And one of the synagogues that they burn is the Great Synagogue of Aleppo, where the Codex is kept. And the book disappears. And rumors reach Israel, or what would become Israel, because the state hadn't quite been declared yet, rumors reach Israel that say the book has been lost. And there's a very striking obituary written for the Aleppo Codex. I can only describe it as an obituary. In January 1948, at the height of Israel's War of Independence, when actual people are being killed, a lot of them, the book is considered so important that it warrants its own obituary in one of Israel's most important daily newspapers, Haaretz. And it's written by a Bible scholar who is mourning the loss of this book because, of course, there were no copies, so the information contained in the book had been lost, or so he thought, and that meant that the perfect text of the Bible had been lost and would never be seen again. And he's heartbroken, and he writes a very striking article about it. However, it turns out that the rumors of the loss of the Codex are actually kind of a carefully concocted fabrication. And it had been cooked up by the leadership of the Jewish community in Aleppo. They knew that the Syrian government wanted to get its hands on the Codex, which was known to be very, very valuable, and it was a cultural artifact of some importance. The government was trying to find it, and government agents had contacted Aleppo rabbis about the Codex, and they wanted to throw the government off the trail. They wanted to get them off the scent. So they spread the rumor that the book had been burned in the fire, and they spirited it into hiding and hid it in a storeroom in one of the Aleppo bazaars, and it ended up staying there in secrecy for 10 years.
Mm. And so it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of hidden, not hidden in plain sight, but it wasn't, I mean, they didn't have a safety deposit box. They didn't have a special vault underground or anything. They had a storage facility. It just so happened that everybody was able to keep a tight lip. And those people that knew kept the secret, and the Syrian government had no idea that this book that they had thought had been burned by anti-Zionist rioters was actually alive and well.
And under their nose. Aleppo bazaars. It's interesting to note that the first person to hide the Codex before it ended up in its storeroom was a Christian who the Jews trusted. There was a Christian merchant in Aleppo. who was a friend of the Jewish community, and they gave it to him initially, thinking that no one would suspect a Christian. And that was true, and he kept the codex for several months before the Jews moved it from his hands to the storeroom of a very important Jewish businessman in Aleppo, and that's where it remained until 1957.
I want to change a little bit of the direction here of the story, because then it remained there until 1957, and we'll talk about how it migrates to Israel coming up. But what's interesting about that is that as you started, let's talk a little bit about the story of how you even came across the story of the Aleppo Codex, how you as a writer for Associated Press, how this even got on your radar.
It was the summer of 2008, and at the time, as you mentioned, I was a correspondent for the Associated Press. Today I write for a new website called The Times of Israel. I was a correspondent, and I was basically bored with covering politics of the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, which can end up, for a reporter, being a very circular and kind of uninteresting story that wears you down after a few years of covering it. And I knew there were many, many interesting stories to be covered. And I began covering biblical archaeology, and I began covering the antiquities trade. And these are very, very rich stories that get at the story that is under the surface, the story that's behind the headlines here. In the summer of 2008, I was at Israel's National Museum in Jerusalem, and I was in the building where the Dead Sea Scrolls are held. It's called the Shrine of the Book. And on the top floor of that building is the gallery where the Dead Sea Scrolls are held, the Qumran Scrolls. And, of course, everyone knows those manuscripts. They're the closest thing the world of Hebrew manuscripts has to celebrities, kind of the Lady Gaga of the Hebrew manuscript world. And that gallery was full of visitors and tourists. And I walked down a flight of stairs into a dark, basically into the basement, into a dark subterranean gallery. And that gallery was empty, and there was a manuscript in there that I had never heard of. And from the labels in the gallery, I understood that this was Judaism's most important book, and yet I had never heard its name before, and that was the Aleppo Codex. And I wrote a story about it for the AP, this pretty standard news feature. I wrote about the manuscript. I interviewed several academics. I understood that there were pages missing from the manuscript and that was a mystery, and I wrote about that, and I published the story. I believe it was September 2008, and then I started digging deeper because I was intrigued by the story, and I still thought it was quite a simple and straightforward story. And as I dug deeper, I discovered, first of all, that people didn't want to talk to me. They didn't want to answer my questions. They didn't want to go beyond the simple narrative that existed at that time. And eventually I understood that at least some of what I had written in the article was incorrect, because the information in circulation when I wrote the article, basically the information that has been in circulation until last month when my book was published, was false. And it had been circulated in order to protect people, in order to cover up what was a far more interesting but, of course, far dirtier story.
Well, and I want to amplify that a little bit, because you start to ask questions and you immediately start running into a connection with the Mossad, that somehow the people that know the most about the Aleppo Codex end up being Israeli secret agents.
One of the first names I heard when I started looking into the story was the name Rafi Sutton. And Rafi Sutton was an ex-Mossad agent. He was retired by that time. He's almost 80. And I was told that if you're writing about the Aleppo Codex, you have to go speak to Rafi Sutton. So I contacted him, and I sat with him in his living room. He lives in a suburb between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. And I sat in his living room. And Rafi Sutton is almost 80, but he's one of the more imposing people that you'll ever meet. He's a very experienced interrogator. He's an experienced runner of agents, and he did this for many, many decades. And as I write in the book, when Rafi looks at you, you can feel his fingers rummaging around your brain. He looks at you, and you feel like you're going to yield information that he wants, whether you want to or not. A very imposing character. And he sat in his chair in his living room, and on the coffee table, he had placed a file folder full of yellowing documents.
Well, let's leave the story right there. The yellowing documents on the coffee table, and we'll get right back to that. Matty Friedman, the author of The Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible, not just any ancient Bible. And we'll get into the missing pages part. It's really part of the very intriguing aspect of the mystery. Who took those pages? Where are they now? Why can't we know? Next on Coast to Coast.